You are listening to the Experience Points Podcast for the week of July 17th, 2013, and today we bring you a combo breaker.
Everybody, this is the Experience Points Podcast, and my name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Albor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It's a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. I like to think we're pretty good at video games.
Oh yeah, we're pros.
But then when I watch things like Evo, I realize I am an idiot child at video games.
Yeah, it feels like what I've now realized is that I don't play games, I just sort of slobber over a controller.
It's like we are the... In the opening vignette of 2001, we are the, like, pre-humans just kind of banging bones together.
Yeah. Bum, bum, bum. And then we just throw our controller into the air. There's the 360 controller, like, slowly becoming a space station.
And then Daigo kicking it over and putting a fight stick in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, George and I found out that we are terrible at fighting games, and mostly because we've been watching a little bit of Evo over this past weekend. Evo, the Evolution Tournament 2013 happened this past weekend.
It did. Evolution, not exactly the catchiest names to bring in new viewers of fighting game competitions.
But it's been that way for years now, so they're pretty much stuck with it.
Yeah, oh yeah, they're steeped in tradition at this point.
Yeah. And, well, it's nice because, really, like, Evo has never been more vibrant because, you know, the proliferation of streaming and social media means that, like, I had no idea that Evo was taking place this weekend until, like, halfway through, or last weekend, rather, until, like, halfway through last week when people started, like, tweeting about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and they were mostly tweeting about it because Nintendo put the kibosh on Smash Brothers.
Yeah, that was probably... In retrospect, that was probably the best bit of publicity they could have had because I started...
Yeah, because once I saw that, I was like, oh, right, Evo. And then I put it in my calendar and I got, you know, reminders.
Yeah, and then, you know, something happened and people came to some sort of conclusion, either based on, you know, pitchforks and torches or maybe some backroom deal where, like, Nintendo finally was okay with them streaming Smash Brothers, which was, you know, kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big plus when you can actually do what you said you would do.
Yeah, it's I don't know, it's a little weird. But, you know, George and I decided to watch some of the stream. We put some video up on the website, which is pretty neat, of us kind of commentating on fighting games.
Yeah, it was funny, because we went into this going, hey, maybe we should talk about Evo, and then we just sort of sat there and started watching Evo.
Yeah, it's the most efficient podcasting we've ever done. But we decided to do a little bit more of a focused episode, a little recap now that there's been some time to sink in.
Yeah, we may cover some of the same points that we talked about, but this will be a tighter episode, for sure.
Yeah, it'll be much less of us going, oh, no.
Oh, my God, did you just see Peach?
Jigglypuff. So maybe we should start with Smash Brothers, because I had never really... I mean, I have seen competitive Smash Brothers, but it had been a long time since I had seen it.
And this was Smash Brothers Melee.
Yes. The one true 12... Smash Brothers.
The one true Smash Brothers. A 12-year-old game. Shocking to know.
So weird.
There are probably children who were born before, or rather were born, yeah, just after the game came out, who are probably playing it now. You could kick my ass.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add, and I can probably not beat them at all.
There's some 11-year-old who's just insanely good at Melee by now, I'm sure.
It's just so interesting to see a game that you think you're pretty familiar with, because, you know, I played dozens of hours of Super Smash Bros. Melee. I mean, it was, you know, the quintessential party game of, you know, the turn of the century, right? And
yep.
But just seeing how these tournament-level people play it, it's just it's so cheesy to say, but it's a whole other game. You know, like, I would never think to even use Peach, let alone use her moves in that way.
Yeah, exactly. And there were characters that, yeah, like Peach, we would play them as a joke character,
yeah, right?
Like Jigglypuff was a character where all of my friends would get together and we'd play like four Jigglypuffs on screen at once because of how hilariously bad we were all at Jigglypuff.
Yeah.
that someone was playing Jigglypuff legit, and not only that they were legitimately playing, but they almost won.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me. And they're up there fighting with, you know, ice climbers and all, you know, all sorts of
Fox.
Characters. That, yeah, I mean, the Fox is pretty the norm, I think, for Smash Brothers professional matches. And Fox, as a character, did end up winning the entire tournament.
Yeah.
But it was still fascinating to watch all of these players bring in a level of skill into characters that weren't just strange to me, but were totally unique in how they played compared to their competition.
Yep. And, you know, just also, like, aside from the characters, like, the weird, unique thing about Smash Brothers is the stages and just seeing how they compensate for games where, because, I mean, general fighting game tournament etiquette / rules are, like, you play on the most generic stage possible, so the only factors in the match are the skill involved, not the randomness of the stage.
Right.
And just seeing how, you know, in Smash, they try to approximate that a little bit, but there are levels where, you know, you got three platforms and a flat surface, but those platforms might go up and down a little bit. You know, the Kirby level, the wind blew a little bit, and just those little things actually ended up, you know, making a difference every once in a while, which is just fascinating compared to the other kind of flat plane version of fighters.
The wind one in particular was interesting because you'd see people change their style a little bit. Like, they'd buy themselves some time while the wind was blowing.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going through their head. I just know that suddenly something's different.
Yeah. I guess, so should we, we could talk about if we learned anything more about Smash Brothers, or we could talk if, kind of at a high level of, what other games we saw, because I didn't see a huge amount of games.
Yeah, I only saw, I think, 3.5 different types of games. I had it on in the background for the whole day.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of those same lessons that you get from Smash, you could sort of apply to the other games, right? Like, mm-hmm. people are playing at, again, such a high level that it's just, it's kind of a fascinating thing to watch regardless, whether or not you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
But were there any other specific game highlights that you want to talk about? I have a couple, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, there was... Kotaku did a good write-up on this, but the Marvel vs. Capcom tournament, the famous U.S. fighting game contestant Justin Wong came all the way back from the loser's bracket to make it into the finals and then, like, lost by one match, basically. I thought that was a pretty neat sequence of events.
Yeah, that's sad.
Yeah, it was, we should talk about this when we come to the actual competition of it, but, like, seeing how the crowd reacts to him and, you know, during the match, seeing the momentum go back and forth was pretty fascinating. I watched the Street Fighter IV finals just because, you know, that's kind of like the big kahuna of the whole tournament.
It is the big kahuna, yeah. I had friends over, sadly, but I really wanted to, like, put it on in the background.
Yeah.
But it's too nerdy, apparently.
Yeah, I got some weird looks on the bus when I was, like, taking a peek at some of the things that were going on. Yeah.
Yeah, I also caught the Injustice matches, which were just really interesting compared to... Because Injustice does a couple of things that other fighting games don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I get the sense that no one really takes Injustice that seriously since it's so new to the scene and it's, you know, a little over the top. And we talked about with levels playing to a match, but, you know, there's abilities to interact with the environment in Injustice, like
mm-hmm.
throwing lights or masks or whatever. And some heroes in the game, or villains, depending on who you're playing, actually use the environment differently than others. So there was this sort of metagame on top of it, because if you lost a match, you got to choose where the next fight was.
Yeah.
So presumably you would pick a level or a map that gave you a advantage in terms of environmental objects.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of a weird and interesting sort of layer on top of what all the other sort of fighting games have.
And the other thing, like, I mean, I don't call it this to be derogatory, but, like, the other gimmick that it has, you know, other than the stages that, you know, are always, you know, interactive, is that you know, that wager system that they have every once in a while.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the wager system in particular because it seems so strange.
I'm not clear on it completely. Like, I'm not 100% clear on how it actually works.
So for people who don't know what the wager system is, I think it's something that can be triggered in a match.
Yeah.
And what it does is both enemies sort of fly at each other and you get a few seconds to decide how much of your super bar you want to spend on it.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure whoever spends the most super on that attack will knock the other person back and give them some sort of advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the high level of it anyway, and the dynamic that that gives rise to is this this rock, paper, scissors kind of mind game of... It's even... Well, I mean, I guess it's more... It's a wager. It's better than rock, paper, scissors because you can kind of bluff your opponents.
Right. Except for whenever I was seeing it used, for the most part, it was one person who had a full super bar and somebody who had very little. And it seemed also that a good portion of the time, they were using it to get percentage of their health back. But it was interesting to watch, to see sort of, you know, how each opponent was reacting to the wager system. And it was also interesting to see how... The other thing I thought was interesting was sometimes the commentators would talk about the wager system in a way that, you know, you don't really see in fighting games. They'd be like, oh, I don't know, he got 20% of his life back, but I think he made the wrong call there because really, you know, Superman's going to be able to chip away at, at that health bar and that health gain. And he really needed his super at this point. So, again, it was a second level of meta commentary that was going on with commentators as well that I thought added some cool flair to the viewing of the match. Yeah. You know, as someone who I'm not very good at fighting games anyway, let alone, you know, playing anywhere near their skill level. So we don't actually know how the wager system or environmental objects figure into the actual play of the game. But I do know that it made it a little bit more exciting to watch.
And it also, like you were saying, it gave the commentators something to talk about because of the way it affects the gameplay flow. Like, it is a pause in the action, so it gives them precious seconds to kind of explain what's going on to people.
Yeah. And the same actually goes for the transition scenes, because I think maybe twice during a match, you know, one hero will be blasted through the floor or they'll be grabbed by a giant or some shit like that, and then you're in, like, a whole new area of the map, which is kind of a neat scene change for viewers, as well as, like you said, giving them some time to comment on it. Because one of my issues with watching Smash Brothers was just how absolutely fast everything went and how difficult it is for someone who doesn't play at that skill level or doesn't pay much attention to the fighting game scene to actually understand what's going on, what are the stakes, what are the strategies that sort of shape play.
Yeah. I mean, and, like, the saving grace for Smash is that I feel like, you know, for myself anyway, I understand it much more than I would understand something like Marvel vs. Capcom, just because it's a more cerebral game in that you don't have... Not that it's more complicated.
You're not having, like, a light-induced seizure most of the time?
Well, it's also, like, you know, there's only, like, 8 different things that you can do. There's, you know, cardinal direction, right. specials, cardinal direction, normals, you know, charge-ups or whatever. So it's like, you have this move set that is just kind of different and not as focused on, like, 50 hit combos or whatever. And so like when I was watching Marvel vs. Capcom, it's like, I really wish I knew, like, literally what buttons they were pressing to do that, you know?
yeah, for sure. Yeah. And interestingly, in Smash, there were some abilities that people just were not using for whatever reason, probably because they're not very good or they'd open themselves up to attack. So you'd get these scenarios where, for the most part, you're seeing Jigglypuff do the same thing. Jump, 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 over attack.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more, actually, about the announcers, because I feel like that was something we spoke a little bit about on the stream, but we had some ideas. We have some ideas of how to fix esports, George.
we're gonna solve the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, well, first off, did you recognize any of these announcers?
I feel like I recognized one of the guys who was doing the Street Fighter announcing, but I could not tell you from where. I imagine it's from other shoutcasting stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, because I feel like so much of the success of esports somewhat has to do with the personality and personalities, not just of the players, but of the shoutcasters as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to watch these matches, because they would be switching it up. Right, some of the shoutcasters wouldn't be the same one previously, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So someone shouting Infinite Crisis would be shoutcasting Street Fighter, would be shoutcasting Smash Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and again, this comes from someone who does not pay attention to the fighting game competition circuit scene at all when Evo is not online.
Right.
So I'm sure that these people are highly recognizable to a lot of fans out there.
Yeah.
But for someone who's totally new to it, I don't get the sense of ownership of the role necessarily that I might otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I was thinking about it just almost as a problem of the game mechanics themselves. Like, you can be the best announcer in the world, but the games just move so fast that there's very little time to really explain it in the same way that, like, even like if you watch professional sports on television, you know, they will talk about the basics of the game almost week in and week out.
Yeah, yeah. And there's not a lot of, I mean, we talked about this in the show too, but there's just not much prep time either.
Yeah.
Like, Evo was jumping into the matches seconds after completion of the previous match.
Yep.
And you know, when you go into these sorts of things, like, no matter what sport it is, I think you can really have an enriching experience if you understand what are the dominant strategies this player uses, what is their history, their past, what can we expect from the characters that they're choosing to play as. And there just wasn't any time for that. There wasn't any time to breathe for that.
Mm-hmm. But
during the match itself and in between matches.
It is interesting to see, like, you know, Evo is still focused on, like, the culture of the contestants rather than the viewers. Like, because if they cared about viewing experience, they might want to, like, make a flashier transition, you know. But all they care about is, like, you know, you can tell there's a bit of a gentleman's agreement between the two combatants, but they're basically, like you were saying, finishing a round and almost instantaneously starting a new round. Like, there's no downtime in between.
Yeah, and I think this comes back to something I was talking about while we were watching the show as well, but I think that it's really interesting to look at the level of professionalism at Evo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at work today talking about Evo, and someone said that they were shocked by how professional it was.
Right.
And I was like, thinking the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Like, compared to the pro matches I see in League of Legends pretty regularly,
mm-hmm.
it looks like amateur hour over there.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, Riot Games invests a huge amount of money into the pro sports scene for League of Legends, but I think you really finally can start to understand why money is so important for the success of having a viewership for something like this.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about, oh, do the shoutcasters have time, but, you know, do they have a big ass monitor? Can they slow down and show replays?
Right.
You know, can they comment on those replays? Can they draw on a big whiteboard you know, like John Madden or something?
Right.
Do the seats look comfortable? Right? Like, are the mics working well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, simple things like that contribute to the entire atmosphere of it. And as someone who doesn't view it a lot, I was sort of struck by how casual it was.
Yeah, even in this climate of, like, the kind of MOBA side of esports, like, the fighting game scene is still very, like, you might as well be seeing it 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Like, it's the kind of accoutrements, you know, around it haven't changed all that much, seemingly enough.
And I think if you're in that scene, you could probably love it. I mean, maybe you like that gritty, dirty DIY aesthetic, you know? And you certainly get that from some of the sort of conjunction between, you know, hip-hop culture and fighting game culture, and the way that the shoutcasters sort of are rough and tumble in the way that they talk about things. They'll just, you know, throw out swear words, and they'll use slang, and they're clearly having a good time, and that's a great feeling to see and to watch. But, you know, having that level of professionalism as well just makes it an easier viewing experience. So there's got to be some middle ground there.
Well, remember when we watched, last year we watched the I Got Next documentary?
Yes.
And there was that huge, gosh, I'm really blanking on his name, but, you know, he was a very polarizing figure because he was trying to take fighting games more mainstream, and people were worried about this exact thing that we're talking about. Like, you start injecting money into it, and then who owns it? Is it really about the fighters anymore, or is it about the advertisers, or is it about the personalities behind the announcers? Is it about the fans that never play but just watch? You know, like, you start diluting, you know, what it started out as, which is just a bunch of people creating a fighting tournament for other people that fought in those tournaments.
Right. I mean, to me, that just feels like a sort of, it's a growing pain that might have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, I'm not in that community. I'm not embedded in it. So
yeah.
I don't have the same stakes that other people do. But, you know, I remember we left watching I Got Next. You Got Next? He Got Next?
We All Got Next.
Oh, We All Got Next. Okay, good. I remember finishing that documentary and thinking that I was really hopeful and really inspired by the people who were dedicating so much of their life to trying to up professionalism and the level of seriousness that not just the fighting game community takes their own sport, but the world takes their sport.
Mm-hmm.
And watching Evo, it seems to me that really has not come very far at all since that doc. And it was kind of actually sad to see. You know, I think at one point we were watching the Smash Brothers tournament, and the two players didn't realize it was the best 2 out of 3 match instead of a best 3 out of 5 match.
Yeah.
And that was just sad to watch.
That was pretty rough.
It seemed so unprofessional. It was awkward on the stage. I felt bad for the competitors. And I kept thinking about that documentary as well, and how, you know, it seemed like they were so sincere about stepping up their game when it came to fighting game scene. And I don't know, maybe it's just my shallow impression, but it seems like there's still so far to go.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, like, take an analog from professional sports as like a warning of how things can go wrong. Like, take a look at professional American football, where the pace of the game has gotten to the point where it's also dictated by, like, television schedules and advertisement blocks.
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
So it's kind of like that is what the fighting game community seems to be on constant guard against, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you see some of that backlash at Evo, right? I think at one point we were done in our segment on whatever we have on YouTube, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was right after or right before the Injustice matches, and the Killer Instinct team came on the stage,
yeah,
and they said that they were launching exclusively on Xbox One,
mm,
and the crowd booed. There's like a loud, audible boo, the whole, yeah, crowd going boo and stuff. Oh, it was such a weird experience, because it's like, yes, I get it. You know, you guys don't think the Xbox One is very cool, and screw these guys, but at the same time, these people are giving you some money to rent out this very expensive room.
Mm.
Like, I don't know.
It's hard, though, because, you know, if they want the fighting game community to take it seriously, like, is that a choice the publisher would have made if they really cared about it? You know, like, we're talking about a very niche community, and, like, the people who are going to take the new Killer Instinct seriously are not the people who are playing, like, tournament-level Street Fighter 4. You know, it's for schmucks. It's for jabronis like us, you know? Like,
yeah, I'm just tempted to say that surely we can find a middle ground, right? Like, yeah, maybe the answer is stop playing these mainstream games and start playing, like, I don't know, smaller, medium-level studio games that at least there's some backing. You know, maybe there's a community manager out there who'll help you because they're invested in the game as much as you are, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I look at something like, I don't know, PlanetSide or Warframe or something, right? Some of those, like, free-to-play massive shooters that do competition and stuff. Like, you know, those aren't as big as, you know, a Street Fighter tournament necessarily, but there's interest in strengthening the community for players of those games. In a way that, when you look at what Nintendo did for Smash Brothers, is just, like, insulting. Like,
yeah.
And you had mentioned this during the stream as well, but at one point they thanked Nintendo for letting them play the game.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think that's the mentality that you should go into this with if they're really so cold.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's so many things that are pushing and pulling the fighting game scene both ways, right? Because, you know, you want to play the really good games, and sometimes those really good games are made by these big publishers, but the publishers don't give a shit about you.
Mm.
And you also don't want money involved, but also need some money to have better equipment and pay shoutcasters and even pay the professional players.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of a mess.
Yeah, and, you know, you could go two ways with it. You could go the MOBA way, which is centralization. You know, have a big company behind it that kind of dictates the rules. Or you can go, like, as much anarchy as can be possible and still put on a huge tournament in Las Vegas, which is, like, the more Evo way of doing it, where, like, you know, they have an unofficial, like, betting after-hours match, and, you know, the people are kind of trash-talking, and it's a little bit more do-it-yourself, like you were saying. I mean, it's difficult to know where the balance is, but, you know, just from the cultural perspective, even if I don't admire everything about the fighting game community, I do understand what they're trying to do in the face of the more professionalization of esports.
Yeah, that's very true. And I definitely admire the people who are clearly dedicating huge chunks of their lives to something that is not getting them any amount of money or even sort of fame.
Yeah. How about just the overall idea of esports, because it brings up, you know, Smash Brothers brings up something, because it's not even the most current Smash Brothers, you know, it's the GameCube version, you know.
Yeah, that's 12-year-old.
Yeah. And, you know, Injustice is, you know, it was its first year because you know, people are trying to figure out whether you could even play it in a tournament, whether the balance is proper. You know, and we have this other community going on, like the Dota/LOL community, where it's like, you know, League is pushing updates and they're very transparent about it. And I'm just wondering if you saw any parallels as to what you see, because you know, you follow the scene much more closely than I do in terms of esports, I feel like.
Yeah, you mean parallels between the way that Evo is managed and the way that League is managed?
Or, like, do you think just fighting games by their nature, because they're more like installment based rather than service based, for a lack of a better term, like, you know, do you notice a difference in how people play them, or like how you think the future would go?
Yeah, it's strange, because I feel like part of it is that sort of big push release date, and you get people who are really adhering to sort of the systems, right? Like, theoretically, they could play Brawl, but there's this strong strain and belief that Brawl is a lesser fighting game. It undermines some of the core of what makes fighting games interesting, and so it's not. And I can really appreciate that, right? Because what they're trying to capture is a specific type of sport or a specific type of experience that maybe Brawl doesn't offer. You know, that being said, I see no reason why it can't follow some of the same patterns we see in others. Like, you know, League of Legends gets those patch updates, and I think right now the pro players in championship series that's going on for League of Legends play about 2 weeks behind the actual patch.
Right.
And that's for a couple of reasons. One is because it takes time for those players to get comfortable with the updates and change their strategy and practice. And two, you're going to find way more bugs when you actually pump that out to the crowd. But the point being is, because they have that delay, they're still offering up excellent high-level play, but also updating that experience each time you watch it, right? Season 3 of League of Legends does not look like the same professional play experience in Season 1. That's not just because there's champions, but because core gameplay ideas have changed and shifted around and augmented.
Yeah.
In the ability, with the ability to pump updates to even fighting games, release new characters, release new maps, you know, if you got something like Injustice, if you start adding new environmental things or something, I don't know, you could start adding, I think, a really cool level of player to the professional scene in a way that isn't normally seen, while also, I think, still adhere to some of those same core principles of what makes a fighting game interesting and why do you choose to play it in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just seems so much more, you know, like it revolves. It's kind of like it stays the same for a while, and then a new release comes out, and then, you know, everyone has to either make this big decision or this big shift based on what decision they made, if they want to play the new game or not.
I wonder how much is just stubbornness.
I mean, well, that's, people have made this argument with, you know, professional Call of Duty or professional Halo or something.
Well, and real sports as well, right? Like, when things change in real sports, people will, like, give up a huff and a puff.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, a professional athlete isn't gonna, you know, hang up his cleats because they made a change in football, whereas, like...
Yeah, that's true.
If Justin Wong didn't like the new Street Fighter, he could just be like, no, I'm not playing it, and neither should you. And he'd probably, like, fracture the community.
Yeah, that's very true.
So, but it's like, imagine if, like, Jerry Rice at his prime was like, no, I don't like this new touchback rule, I'm not gonna do it. You know, like, the NFL would laugh at him.
That's true. But is that a place we want to be? Like, is that a good place to be?
I don't know. It's just an interesting thing, because there's no real central mechanism for it, and the fact that, you know, we don't really talk about sports and video games in the same breath lots of times, but, you know, regular sports, they do change the rules all the time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's a much more League of Legends-style experience. Like, basically, every year, all professional sports get patched.
Yeah, so to that extent, wouldn't you say that fighting game scene has to sort of grow up, it has to advance in that way? Or we're okay with updates, patch changes, and things like that?
Well, I mean, it will... I think... You know, this may explain some of the boos for the new Killer Instinct, but I feel like this new console generation is really like the first console generation that was both designed, conceived, and released in a world that is completely online all the time.
Yes, totally.
And so there might be differences, but I mean, when you're still designing for machines that could function offline and were designed to function offline, then you can get away with this old kind of 1990s style mentality where you release a game every 3 or 5 years and then, you know, people learn the new one.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, but at the same time, with the sort of newfound ability of both the PS4 and the Xbox One to stream matches. I feel like, to some extent, if you were stuck playing a game that came out 3 years ago, or if you say, oh yeah, you know, we really don't feel like taking this particular fighting game seriously because there's too many patches or something like that, then the people who are actually playing those games are just going to leave you behind.
Yeah, because there would be a critical mass of...
hope, right? The hope is that, I mean, not to say I have any sort of high hope for the new Killer Instinct, but imagine that the next Killer Instinct is awesome, right? And they do patches regularly, and people start streaming their own matches online, and a sort of competitive scene starts growing up around that game that maybe doesn't share a lot of the same roots that the other fighting game scene has.
Yeah.
What's going to happen there, right? How are those two communities going to either merge or not merge or relate to one another? Because as we see it right now, like, some of the players of these fighting games, you know, the people who played in Injustice also played in Marvel.
Yeah.
Or, and you'd see some people who've been playing competitive Street Fighter for years. You know, they've been in the scene for a while. Some of the announcers I know have been in the scene for a while. So, you know, and that's a scene that was relatively niche. So if esports can be taken seriously, if PlayStation 4 and Xbox One start to do a better job of promoting that type of content, and in a sort of long-term relationship, publishers start wanting to utilize that type of content by supporting esports, then I think that the place of the current fighting scene, they sort of have to make a decision at some point. Because if it does grow and a scene is built around it that is a bit more centralized, then you have to decide, are we going to jump on the bandwagon? Are we going to try to claim a space at this table? Or are we going to try to still remain our sort of own DIY, you know, do-it-yourself fighting game mentality?
Yeah. And I guess the only other precedent for something like that would be maybe the first StarCraft, where people played, you know, the first StarCraft for years and years and years, and Blizzard, like, is super careful whenever they change it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, and even that is moving towards a more dynamic model of things. You know, they're releasing the, you know, second part of StarCraft 2. You know, they're going to eventually release the third part of StarCraft 2. And each time they do it, they make some major changes. But, you know, there was a decade there where people were just playing StarCraft.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, at this point, a lot of those pro players are being brought in to consult and practice beta testing. And not just now, but for each of the upcoming patches, I'm sure, as well, right? So. Yeah. They have an intimate role with people making games.
Yeah. So, to shift gears a little bit, do you think that there's something... How do you feel about the one-on-one style of esports versus the team style of esports?
Yeah, this is something I mentioned as well. I think that team sports are way more watchable, personally. And I think this goes for pretty much any sport, like boxing compared to, I don't know, team boxing. That thing
that's called hockey.
Yeah, you know, there's a
but boxing is just two guys hitting the crap out of each other. Like, how, what do you mean by understandable?
You're right. I guess I don't mean necessarily understandable, because I think that fighting games are relatively understandable, right? Like, a guy gets punched in the face, he's out.
I guess I
mean more view, like there's more reasons to watch. You know, it's partially about fandom. Right? If one person on the team is super popular or charismatic, then you could bond to that, but it doesn't mean this other guy has to. The other guy can watch for a different reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm personally more interested in the way that team dynamics work as a whole, how teams coalesce and how they meet together and work as a team strategically. I think that's a really interesting level of dynamics. You don't see it in a fighting game. And I also think that there's a bit more buzz around. Well, it's just sort of easier to rally people around the idea of a team, and maybe even to some extent imagining how you could be in that team. You know?
Yeah. Because it taps into that kind of tribal instinct everyone has of like, oh, this is a community that I could be a part of.
Like, I could be the best if I pushed hard enough, if I trained.
Well, I mean, I could be the best if I pushed hard enough and trained. Sounds much more like a fighting game mentality where it's like,
yeah, that's true.
You are by yourself, but it's like, oh, I could be part of this larger thing, you know, and share it with people is like the other way of looking at it, which would be kind of more the league looking.
Yeah.
You
know. I mean, I don't know how biased I am though, right? Because there's some people who are really into boxing and really into singular, you know, one-on-one sports, right? Like, you talked a bit about tennis in our previous thing,
right?
How the one versus one tennis matches are much more, I don't know, quote unquote, legitimate than, say, 2v2s.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. It's not something that, to me, is particularly interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is, and, you know, Wimbledon just wrapped up a couple weeks ago, and so, you know, we got to see this in action, but as a producer of a one-on-one sport like tennis, you have to have a good narrative of, like, who these people are. Like, it was a huge deal that a Brit won Wimbledon, because, you know, what a great narrative that is. You know, it hadn't happened since, you know, the 50s or the 40s or whenever, you know? And so you have to have the show business side of things, basically, to kind of draw in the people to the human aspect for that population, which is a sizable population of people that aren't there just for the pure mechanics of the sport.
Yeah, you know? but you think that team-based games, you can sort of bring people in for the allure of mechanics and sort of set aside some of the politics and, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think it's just more of a numbers thing. Like, you know, you could love Andre Agassi, but if you only like him and don't care about tennis, you'll never watch tennis. But you could love Shaq, you know, or when Shaq and Kobe played on the same team, you know, but you could also love LeBron. You could love a bunch of different people on different teams. And by proxy, you kind of get a sense of the other folks on the team because you're drawn in by the stars. And then you get to know the rest of the team dynamic. So you just, like, playing the percentages, you're much more likely to latch on to more people when there's more people on the court.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I also think that when you have different people who are playing by different teams in a way, it's similar to that way, right? Like, if one aspect of a sport doesn't intrigue you, maybe another aspect does.
Yeah.
You know, like, cycling is freaking cool, partially because there's so many people who play on a team in cycling, and they all sort of have their own different role. So if one thing doesn't interest you, you can move around to another and think about interaction between the two, right? If you watch a soccer match, I think there's most people will ask you, oh, what's your favorite position, or what position would you play, or did you play if you ever once played soccer? And, you know, for the most part, people go, oh, I love goalies, or I love strikers, or I love defensemen, right? Because they're finding one aspect of the overall sport that they can cling on to. The more of those you have, the more likely you are to draw in a wider audience.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, fighting games tap into that, you know, kind of the sweet science of, you know, the same thing that boxing taps into, you know, like there are two people and there's a very simple set of rules. And so there's very little to attribute to luck and very little to attribute to other people's successes or failures. You know exactly who won and why they won, which is, you know, kind of the allure of, you know, very, very few other games are like that. Even, like, I guess maybe the last thing that I can remember is, like, when, you know, Quake was really popular on the tournament scene, because it was mostly death matches. It wasn't, like, capture the flag type matches, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that stuff is really, if you can package it correctly, and if people are interested in both the mechanics and also the personalities behind it, there is a lot of, you know, you can have these, like, celebrities, basically, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if that's necessarily a thing that people want, but I mean, it's the allure for me anyway of fighting. It's the same reason why I like tennis, is because there's just a lot of psychological stuff going behind it. You know, someone could lose a match just as easily as someone else could win a match, you know, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons why, even though I think Marvel versus Capcom is painfully difficult to watch, the idea of having a tag team based game, where you can select, like, three characters, they interact with each other differently, all that kind of stuff, is a really cool idea, I think, for enlivening the viewing experience of a fighting game, because you have that level, like you might have in boxing, where it's a lot of play and counterplay and posturing, even during a match. The idea that you can now do that and change that up on the fly because you're playing with so many different characters is really cool.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, that's part of the, you know, maybe that is a potential path of modernization for the fighting game scene, where you have this kind of like tennis in a way, like you have this core of, like, maybe the prestigious will always be this kind of one-on-one, you know, ancient Greek gladiatorial style thing of, like, two people enter, one person exits. But you can have these things around it. Like, why not have doubles? Why not have, like, a tournament off to the side where all items are on in Smash Brothers, you know, like, why not
draft,
exactly. So it's like you have, It's kind of like how they do the dunk contest or the home run derby or something.
Yeah, like, this is like when they have that poor guy come out of the stands to try to get a basket half court.
Yeah, the poor guy comes out of the stands to try to fight Daigo, and Daigo can only use one hand.
I think that would be amazing, though. Like, and having that level, because part of it is that, you know, we take esports super seriously, and gosh, you know, we really, it's something that I think we try to mimic off of actual sports, where
yeah.
Life and death, and yep. If my team loses, I'm gonna cry all week or whatever. But right. There's so many cool opportunities for even more fun, almost carnival-like style stuff.
Yeah.
Around it, that seems like it'd be a natural fit.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's like what you were saying for getting people in and kind of catering to other interests in terms of like team dynamics and stuff. Like that's a way to kind of fold those people in and you know make it a little bit more welcoming for people that might not. You know, they might not be either well-versed enough or interested enough in the human stories behind it to, like, only follow one-on-one, but there's kind of the overall idea of it could be a little bit more alluring if they had a bit more variety.
Right. So we could potentially water it down without diluting it too much.
It's rough. I really don't, like, the fighting game scene is like, one of the most seemingly... You know, because I'm not a part of it. Like, all I do is read about it and watch it. And, you know, I'm in the video game community, but, like, it seems like one of the more conservative areas of the video game community. Like, it's, you know, we want to keep things the way they are, you know?
Yeah.
But it's hard to survive if you want, you know, if you want to have those huge, you know, those huge matches with huge purses for prizes and, you know, huge, like, you know, hotels to stay in. Like, that stuff is going to get really hard to consistently pull off, you know.
For sure. And the moment a game strikes big and someone says, we're gonna have a $1 million prize pack for our tournament,
yeah,
why would you even, like, if you're a pro player, why even bother playing those other games? You might as well train the thing that's gonna pay you.
Unless you have that mentality where it's like, no, I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna keep it real.
You're like,
you
I'm
know?
Not gonna sell out. Yeah.
I would like my 19-inch CRT, thank you very much.
Yeah, but then you have this, like, rift.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I wish, in some ways, I wish I was a little bit more into it, but then again, I do enjoy kind of the critical distance, and also I do enjoy playing other games, because I would need to, like, train for, you know, 19 hours a day in order to be that good.
Yeah, what I will say, though, is kind of like Olympics or any other thing I watched, right? I think I'm much more now interested in getting better at fighting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just put my Street Fighter stick right next to my javelin that I picked up in 2012.
Well, you know, I'm just going to wait it out till the next Smash Brothers comes out. That'll be my game of choice.
I don't know, man. It does. Like, watching that Smash, it's like, oh, when is the Wii U price drop going to happen? Maybe exactly. I should, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all right, well, until that day, I mean, we'll just be waiting and I'll, you know, start going back to Smash Brothers Dojo and reading up on my frames.
There you go.
If you want to write in with your thoughts, questions, comments, our email address is experiencepoints@gmail.com.
And if you want to challenge us to a Smash Brothers duel...
Well, you can't, because they took the servers offline.
Touche. You can find us at experiencepoints.net. You can throw down the gauntlet over there. That's fine. You can also review the show on iTunes and Stitcher. If you do that, we'll love you for a very long time.
Yep, definitely. All right, as always... Thanks everyone for listening, and we will be talking to you next week. Every time we...